Welcome to The Next Step. The next step is figuratively, but also literally in this case, what happens after the first time. It's about figuring out what to do next in life, specifically how to manage the push-pull between ambition and contentment. Like, what do you have to do to achieve the things you want, and how can you be happy if you achieve nothing? Sometimes I wonder, would I be better off spending my time setting goals and making lists or meditating? Perhaps I should do a vision board. How do people make money and grow successful multi-million dollar businesses? Like, what are the actual steps? And are ice baths the answer to everything? I'm Catherine Collette, and this is The Next Step. This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures. This interview is with Jessica Weisberg. Jessica Weisberg is an award-winning writer and producer. Her writing has appeared in The New Yorker, New York Times, Harper's, Atavist, and other publications. She's been nominated for a National Magazine Award and ran the features unit at Vice News Tonight on HBO, for which she was nominated for an Emmy. She's a senior producer at Serial Podcast, and her first book, Asking for a Friend, came out in 2018. I read it last year and absolutely loved it. It is about advice givers, so people who have offered advice to others throughout history. Some examples of prominent advice givers featured in the book are Dale Carnegie, who wrote How to Win Friends and Influence People, Cheryl Strayed of the Dear Sugar column, Dear Abby. Dear Abby was a popular newspaper column in the 1950s. And also another is life coach Martha Beck. The book's super interesting, and so is Jessica. We talk about a bunch of stuff, including the fact that her intention for the book was to take advice givers seriously. She makes this comment that in the advice-giving world, and I'd say this applies to its modern incarnation, the self-help industry too, there is a very thin line between satire and earnestness. And that comment was something that has really resonated with me. There's a meta element too in all of this for me, because if you follow me on Instagram, you will know that one of my next steps in life involves coaching writers, particularly debut authors who want help navigating the experience of publication. You can see info on my website. So talking to Jessica is kind of an elaborate way of analyzing and perhaps critiquing myself and a thing that I am doing. Weird. I hope you enjoy this discussion. I will link in the show notes to Jessica's book. It really is excellent. I highly, highly recommend. Welcome, Jessica.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Now, we are going to start with the book. What is the premise of Asking for a Friend?
The premise of Asking for a Friend is a history of America as told through its most famous advice givers, is I would say the premise of it. And I think of it as sort of an emotional history of America, like how people were thinking and feeling and the advice they sought and the advice that was given in different eras of American life.
Oh, I love that idea of emotional history. I'm going to come back to that. But first, I want to touch on some of the historical aspects of advice giving. You mentioned really early on in the book, and it's something that really struck with me and has stayed with me, that there is this relationship in advice giving, at least in some very notable instances, between satire and earnestness. What is the relationship between these two things?
So it was something that kept coming up as I kept reading more and more advice. And what was interesting to me is it came up right away. Like the earliest advice is satire. And I think that part of it is that there's something so extraordinarily earnest about seeking advice. And just think about it in your own life, like the act of asking someone to help you or asking someone's thought. It's such a vulnerable thing. Mm. But it's also extremely vulnerable to give advice. And imagine giving advice on a huge platform. There's something even more vulnerable about that. And so a lot of people throughout history have worked around that vulnerability by giving advice in a satirical way. And how it's interpreted is like a whole other matter. Like, do people interpret that advice as satirical or do people interpret that as real? But there's something I think about creating a satirical experience that is very inviting to an advice, to someone seeking advice. Like they're always able to sort of nod to like a possible joke in a way that I think is freeing, right? There's something kind of freeing about that. It makes it a little less scary. It makes it a little less vulnerable to be like, oh, we're also all in on the same joke.
And that satirical element, do you see that as the earnestness exaggerated, or that the satire comes from the opposite of the earnest message? Do you think there's a consistent way that the satire is framed?
Is there a consistent way that the satire is framed? Yeah, there is a consistent way that the satire is framed. I mean, it does vary a bit. Like, one common one is like advice writers create characters who would be like the last possible person you should ever be receiving advice from. Like Benjamin Franklin did that. And he created a character who was giving advice on how to make money and how to be productive. And it was like the laziest, most like the last person you would look to for business advice. And that's pretty consistent. And, and yeah, I think it empowers the person who's seeking advice. It doesn't put you in a deferential state to the person you're looking for advice from. It puts you in a sort of powerful state. And maybe there's something about that's sort of generous. There's something kind of generous about playing the fool, I think. And you do notice that a little, like quite consistently in advice givers.
It is one thing to be intentionally satirical or to play the fool. It is another thing to actually embody the characteristics that you genuinely advise against. And I think there is this idea that has been very enduring, that there is something suspect about professional advice givers. Why do you think that is? Where do you think that comes from?
Yeah, that's so interesting. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I was drawn to this idea of there's this genre in, I wanted to ask you about that, like how popular advice columns are in Australia. But in America, it's extremely popular. Is it popular in Australia?
I feel like, I mean, I think of advice and I think of self-help as the modern kind of incarnation of advice. And certainly self-help is hugely popular. I can't off the top of my head think of a really famous Australian advice giver. There's probably going to be 100 as soon as I get out of this interview that come to mind. But one person that you talk about in the book is Cheryl Strayed, and she certainly had a lot of popularity here.
She did.
When she was writing for The Rumpus.
Yeah, I love Cheryl Strayed, and she's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, actually. The book kind of came out of I wrote a story about her and her column Dear Sugar for The New Yorker. And I think the thing I was really thinking about when writing that story was how for the popularity of advice columns, for their kind of ubiquity in American culture, we have these very simplistic narratives about who advice givers are and what they do. And a lot of them are kind of suspicious, like someone's like trying to pull one over on someone, or someone's just doing it for the money. And for some reason, it's there's a caricature of advice givers in America that that seems simplistic. And I wanted to explore that. That was one of the reasons why I wrote the book. And when I wrote that story about Cheryl Strayed and Dear Sugar, I was working at The New Yorker at the time, and one of the things I was doing there is I was writing book reviews for the back of the magazine. They're unauthored. And I remember the Dear Sugar book had just come out, and I was like, oh, maybe I'll review this for the magazine, And then I was like, oh no, we're never going to review this. Like this would never be reviewed in The New Yorker. And I was thinking,
Your boss says that
there wouldn't be. Yeah. Right. And he's got impeccable taste, nothing against him. But like, I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, why wouldn't we review a book that's really popular by a very popular author who's like very accomplished in fiction as well? Like, why not? Like, why are we so, like, why does this, why are we so fearful to take this seriously? And I think when you're fearful of taking something seriously, you tend to simplify it. You tend to like just sort of box it into narratives that are sort of like, I don't know, easier to set aside. And I think that's what happened to advice givers, and that mm-hmm. it's sort of just this, like they're quacks. They're I don't believe this. This is the narrative I think exists around advice givers. And that's part of the reason why I was interested in writing the book, because I was like, it has to be more complicated than that. These are people who are interested in some level in helping people. And they're people who are interested in sort of wading through some of the most complicated emotional matters that come up in a person's life. It has to be more complicated than that.
That idea of seriousness is a really interesting one, because I think just as for people who give advice, that satire offers a safety in some ways, equally for people who follow advice or follow self-help, whatever that looks like, there is this push-pull of acknowledging that following as being earnest and serious and also being self-deprecating about it. So it feels like it works for all parties to have this duality that you kind of move between.
I think so too. And it was interesting to me that duality has existed throughout all time. Like we've been using similar tools to sort of mitigate the challenges of being vulnerable since the 1600s.
Mm. Before you mentioned the words emotional history, could you elaborate on what the idea of an emotional history is?
Sure. When I was doing the research for this book, I read a couple of books that were sort of compendiums of emotional history in America, and it was a subdiscipline, I guess you would call it, that I didn't know about. And the idea behind it is that there are emotional trends. There are emotional trends just the way there are cultural trends and just the way there are political trends, and that there are historians who are interested in finding ways of documenting them and categorizing them, and that advice columns are kind of an interesting way of doing that, because it's this very like popularized way of documenting the kinds of questions people had, especially because this is somewhat the true now in advice columns, but this was really the case when, for instance, like there were really popular newspaper advice columns like Dear Abby, that it wasn't just the advice columnists responding, but often readers would respond. And because of that, you're seeing, it's a real glimpse on how people view things, like everything ranging from like extramarital affairs to parenting to, you know, the all sorts of etiquette and other issues. And it was a way of sort of, advice columns were this way of sort of taking the temperature in various emotional matters, because they are this uniquely public and also uniquely vulnerable and emotional thing. Mm. and that interested me about them.
Do you think that in that context, and maybe there, it doesn't go one way or the other, but do you think that advice givers tend to lead social change or social trends, or they reinforce more dated ways of being?
That's a very good question. I think most of the advice columnists I write about in my book, which is not to say, and I think I was specifically interested in advice columnists who were very popular and who were trying to sort of reflect a sort of national zeitgeist in a way that, you know, some advice columnists, and I write about this in the book, were sort of are more tailored to specific communities. I would say the advice columnists that I write about are largely are sort of they want to have a conversation about the issues of their time. Mm. And if they stick around for long enough, you see their actual viewpoints change. Their viewpoints on intermarriage and like interreligious marriage. Sorry, I said that incorrectly. Interfaith marriages change, and their ideas on sexuality change. And I think that's because what they were interested in was not leading a revolution so much as being a sort of a focal point of a conversation. And so for the most part, they are not kind of revolutionaries. Not to say advice columnists can't be revolutionaries, but those aren't the ones who I'm, for the most part, most of the people writing my book are not.
As you mentioned, the book goes through a number of different, kind of chronologically goes through a number of different prominent advice givers. There are a couple that I'm particularly interested in. One is Dale Carnegie, who wrote How to Win Friends and Influence People. This is actually how I discovered the book. We were just saying off air that there was an excerpt that appeared in New Yorker about you going to Dale Carnegie School.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I am interested to know, how do you characterize Dale Carnegie's advice?
I would characterize Dale Carnegie's advice as you are the agent of your own destiny. He really believes in the individual. He really believes that in individual power and individual capacity, and it's very positive. And it's it's a real message of positivity and in control, that you have a lot of you can control your destiny through positivity.
And what does it say about the world that he lived in, that that is his philosophy?
I mean, I think it said, so he really became popular during the Great Depression, and he's so positive and he's so hopeful, and he gave people a lot of hope at that time, and a lot of hope in their own individual capacities for change, as opposed to sort of relying on larger governmental or larger institutional change. So his popularity at the time makes a lot of sense to me. And I also understand why people, he's really popular now. I mean, I mentioned this in the book, but one of the reasons I was interested in Dale Carnegie is because I had written a story about a group of former convicts who had just gotten out of prison, and they were trying to start their own businesses, because in America there's a lot of restrictions on people who've served in prison where they're allowed to work. And so they were working on starting their own businesses, and they had read Dale Carnegie in prison, and they had found it so useful and so inspiring and so helpful. And I thought there was something really poignant about that this is a community that America does not support. Our recidivism rate is unbelievable in America, and we leave former prisoners to their own devices to create a life after prison. And it's not, and like statistically that is not successful, but it made so much sense to me that Dale Carnegie would speak to that group, because they're not getting the support of an institution. They're not getting, they really are on their own. And Dale Carnegie said, that's all you need. You can take care of yourself and get everything you want with a positive attitude and a little bit of luck.
Yeah, he offers hope in that respect. I think the thing that I always remember about reading Dale Carnegie is this, and I think it's great advice, the name using.
Oh, totally.
It's sort of his signature thing. And it's surprising how, I know when you meet people, if they remember your name, how endearing that is, to have a name remembered.
I know, it's true. It really does make a difference.
Another advice giver that you mention in the book is Martha Beck. Martha Beck is a life coach. This is kind of really the modern incarnation of advice giving, particularly in that sort of slightly suspect element, I think. How do you think life coaching is different, or is it different from the forms of advice or advice giving that precede it?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting about the kind of advice Martha Beck is giving is so different than the kind of advice that that was being given and being sought like a few decades earlier. And so much of her advice is about like encouraging her clients and her readers to really put themselves first and to really do what feels good for them and for their own career and for their own family life. And, you know, it's 2023, but you know, it's not that long that women received that message. Like for so many years, it was the opposite of putting others first, families first. And I think that Martha Beck gives that message, and also life coaching is such an embodiment of that lifestyle. It's such an embodiment of like it's such an embodiment. Life coaching is such an embodiment of self-actualization. Like you're saying, like, I'm so self-actualized that I can help you self-actualize. It's, you know, it's, you're not working for anyone else. You're working for yourself. And so I think that she really, she's preaching a lifestyle that's really geared towards self-care. And I think that self-care and self-help have become intertwined in our current world, I would say. Like, I feel like there's a lot of the two kind of go hand in hand. But when I think Martha Bexbury is unusual from her predecessors that way in really kind of encouraging self-care. And then again, whether it's like suspect and, I mean, again, it's like the thing that's suspect about life coaching is that you're implicitly saying, I have the tools to help you, right? And that's a big claim. That's a big claim, you know? And so with big claims come some raised eyebrows and it makes sense if that's the case. But, you know, it's not, to me, what was interesting about it was that the thing that she was offering and that she is teaching other people to offer just seemed like really reflective of like what we consider a good life now, especially like what we can, what women consider a good life now and how that's really changed in over the decades. And that really interested me.
That's a really positive spin because I think it's very easy to be cynical, particularly in that.
It is. And like, I said, I would say that like the thing that was really challenging about writing this book is that I wanted, part of the reason why I wrote the book is I felt that advice givers were important. They were important figures in American life and that there was no book that totally treated them, took them seriously. Mm. And I wanted to take them seriously, but I also did not want to be sort of overly critical and cynical. And I sort of decided to only focus on advice givers who I felt like I had learned something from, which is not to say, if you read the book, you'll see I have criticisms of all of them, like including Martha Beck. But I, part of what interested me is like, what if we take these figures seriously? What if we take their messages seriously? What if we take like their role in history seriously? And is there a way to take them seriously without just criticism and cynicism? Because I think that's what often happens when people are writing about the self-help. You're just like, to take it seriously means to criticize it. And I was just trying to complicate that. How do you take it seriously and criticize it, but not just in a, like a cynical way. So yeah, like I feel like Martha Beck is one of those people who, I think it's possibly one of the more critical chapters of the book. But at the same time, like I think she's interesting. And I think she, you know, clearly a lot of people learn a lot from her. I find her very interesting.
To, I guess, now continue down a somewhat critical kind of path, and this is not a criticism of Martha Beck specifically, there is a thing about life coaching. There is an element that is a way of making money is to coach people, but a way of making more money is to coach people on how to coach people. If that makes sense, it sort of almost becomes a pyramid scheme. The arc of the life coach is to start out coaching individuals and then sort of coach larger groups and then teach other people how to coach. Has advice giving always had a relationship to making money?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely not, it's popular. It's a popular product. It has always been a popular product and it's always come from newspapers. And it makes newspapers money. It makes individuals money. Which is okay. Yeah, totally. And that interested me too. Like, what is like a thing that interests me a lot as a writer and a journalist is how our culture treats things that are created for or by women. And I think that advice columns historically have been something that has been kind of feminized in American culture. And because of that, I wonder if there's a little bit more criticism about the fact that it's a money-making proposition, just because there is so much more criticism around women, unfortunately, making money or doing things for money than there are about men in our culture. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing wrong with making a popular product. people want advice. Like, it's like, if you could, it's very human to want advice. It makes sense that it would be a popular thing to, it makes sense that it's popular.
It is also a curious idea though, isn't it? That we appeal to strangers for answers to our most intimate things. There used to be, for example, and I understand why this one was popular, a popular advice column was, I don't know if you had Dolly magazine, but there was Dolly Doctor, which was like a teen magazine. And so Dolly Doctor, you would write questions to Dolly Doctor, and Dolly Doctor would answer the questions. And I swear every second question was about, you know, my boobs are not exactly the same size one is bigger than the other. Dolly Doctor would, that was like the number
what
one
do I
questions.
Do?
Yes, exactly. How important do you think an anonymity is in asking for advice?
Oh, so important. So important. I do think that, like, if you were to categorize all the different questions about advice, I would say, like, a lot of them fall into the categories, am I normal? Is this normal? And I think there's something about being able to ask that in an anonymous way that makes that question feel possible. And are having boobs of two different sizes normal? Like, that's like so many of the questions are truly different ways of asking the question of, am I normal or is this normal?
There is this Facebook group attached to the area that I live in, and it's kind of like a mother's group. You join, it's called Darabin Mother's Group. And so you join when you have a child, but it's run for quite a long time. So there's probably 20,000 people in this group, maybe not quite that many, but you sort of never really leave. The posts are generally anonymous, like people take away their name, but very occasionally you'll recognize, or you think you recognize the person who is posting, that can kind of like, I think that might be my friend so-and-so. There is this perverse pleasure in recognizing or believing that you recognize a post that's intended to be anonymous.
Yeah. I mean, I think it combines like two really human instincts. One is for connection and one is for mystery, you know? You know, like there's a reason people like spending their time on the internet trying to solve crimes. And there's also a reason that people spend time on the internet trying to find their people, you know? And I think anonymous advice columns like combine both of those instincts.
There's a great actually example in the book that feels very modern, that is a guy who posts responses to questions on Quora. Is that how you say it?
Yeah,
Quora.
Yeah, Mike King.
So interesting. Could you talk a little bit about Mike King?
Yeah. You know, the challenge of figuring out who to write about in a contemporary space is that there's not, advice columnists aren't ubiquitous anymore. Like I feel like in, you know, like everyone once knew who Dear Abby was. Everyone knows who Dale Carnegie is. Every parent of a certain generation knows who Dr. Spock is. And now I feel like advice is more, I think it speaks to the sort of how much more segmented our society is, but there aren't as many figures that sort of speak to like huge swaths of Americans. Like I I was sort of like, so who do I look to? Like, who do I look to think about a contemporary advice giver? And so I just did it by numbers. And I went on Quora and I was like, who is the person giving the most advice on Quora? Like, who is responding to the most number of people? Who has created a persona of ubiquity for himself on this platform? And the answer was very obviously Mike King. Like, he had written so many responses to so many questions that varied so widely in terms of their intensity and their specificity and their subject matter. And he just answered all of them. And I was just like,
Quora, we should say, is just people ask questions. It's kind of Reddit.
Yeah, that's all it is. Sorry, I should have said that. It's sort of like, Quora is a lot like Reddit, but Quora is like a lot like Reddit, but every Everything starts with a question as opposed to like a general conversation. And so people post all sorts of questions and Mike King was answering them. And I really
like thousands, them. Answered thousands.
Thousands. And like treats it like a full-time job, even though he was not being paid for it. And I was just so curious who this man was and what motivated him and why he did it. And that's why I reached out to him.
Jessica, a lot of our listeners are writers. I want to talk very briefly about other types of writing, narrative, storytelling work that you've done. You are a senior producer at Serial Podcast. You made a comment in an interview, this is from a little while ago, you were working for a film production company that partnered with Serial. This was around the season two of Serial. And you said that you thought it was a really interesting idea, this taking of specific journalistic projects and sort of creating the most blockbuster treatment of them possible. That really, this idea of taking a journalistic project and giving it a blockbuster treatment is a really interesting one. Is that the goal of the Serial podcast?
No. So I should clarify. So that was when I was working for a film production company that did partner with Serial. But the goal of that film production company was to bring journalistic stories to the big screen. But the goal of Serial is quite different than that.
What is the goal of Serial?
Well, when I worked on season two of Serial back in 2015, it was a podcast that came out every 2 years, and it was one story and was always hosted by Sarah Koenig. And I think Sarah Koenig is really interested in the criminal justice system. And I think so much of her reporting is really focused on that subject. In the intervening years, Serial has become a company. And so we now do 5 shows a year. We now do 3 to 4 shows a year. And I'm currently working on a show that is hosted by Sarah, and she's wonderful, and that's great. But that's not all Serial is. Mm. And so the mission of Serial is really broadened. And I would say, like, if you look across our shows, I would say they're always stories that we hope surprise people. I think we're always looking for stories that surprise people. I think we're always looking for stories that really, like, stretch the limits of audio storytelling, that are sort of playing with form, is like, I think, something really important to us. And yeah, I think, like, we're journalists, and I think that we seek stories where our investigative and, like, journalistic instincts are of use. Where, you know, and it's not to say, like, we're not doing news per se, but our stories do tend to have a kind of, we want to discover something. And I think the experience of discovering something as you're reporting and sharing that experience with the listener has been something that Serial has done.
Mm. You've also worked across different mediums, written, print, audio, video. How do you know the right medium or the form that a story will take?
Oh, that's a really good question. When I was working at The New Yorker, the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick, had this term called the gods of nonfiction. And he's like, sometimes the gods of nonfiction, like, smile upon you, and you're like, there, like, at the exact moment that something really interesting happens, you know, when you get to write about it. And I would say that in writing, when the gods of nonfiction don't smile upon you, you still have the ability to recreate it. You can talk to people who were there and still write something fairly, like, quite vivid, you know. And sometimes you read stories and magazines, books where, like, the person wasn't there at all, but they just are able to do the research to create a scene that feels so vivid as if they were there. And then when you get into audio and video, you really do need the gods of nonfiction to smile upon you, because you can't recreate it. You need to capture it in tape or capture it on video. And so when you're doing something, so I think, you know, when I'm thinking of what to tell a story, I think about, like, how much access do I have? If I have a lot of access, and it's a contemporary story, it makes a lot more sense to do it in audio than print. Whereas if I have no access, then it's sort of like I'm sort of circling things and taking notes and recreating, trying to create something from my observations exclusively, then I lean more towards doing something in print.
That's a really good way of framing that.
Oh, thank you.
I guess also potentially within elements of an audio piece, you could you could adopt that same philosophy in some ways if you don't have an element. You can kind of try and create it in a written way that is read aloud. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, so many of the hosts of serial shows are such wonderful writers, like Sarah Koenig, such an incredible writer. Susan Burton, such an incredible writer. Dana Chivas is such a great writer. Zoe Chase is such a great writer. I could go on and on. So they can do it, like they can. But when you're taking full advantage of the medium, it's because you have the tape and because you were there. So it's not like so it's like, it's something you can work around, of course. And if if there's a story you feel the need to tell, then you should tell it, whatever medium is most natural to you. But that's how I think of it. And I'm thinking about the best medium for a story. Actually, there's talking about Cheryl Strayed, like I remember advice she gave an aspiring writer, and it was like, when your story feels like a second heartbeat, it's time to put it down. And I think that's just very lovely advice. Like when it feels like a second heartbeat, you have to tell it. You just you can tell it however you can get around any restrictions of any medium if you feel like it's a story you need to tell.
That is great advice, Cheryl.
just parroting her.
Yes. Jessica, you worked as a fact checker and obviously a contributor as well, but fact checker for The New Yorker. What aspect of the fact checking experience has stuck with you the most?
Paranoia, I would say, number one. the fact that like you can comb through something a million times and there can still be a mistake. It really has stuck with me. So there's that. I think the thing I learned as a fact checker was just how to ask the hardest questions. Because when you're a fact checker, you're like, you don't have a lot of time. It's like you have a week until the magazine has to close. You've just gotten this story and you have to go back and be like, so I'm looking at this article and I just want to make sure to see, like, so you had an affair with your wife in 2014. And so you just have to be confident. Like you have to actually be a very confident asker of questions to be a fact checker.
Jessica, we are nearly at the end. I have just a couple of quick fire questions. Some may resonate more than others, so you can pass on any question. Okay, the first one is, what is the best thing you've bought for less than $100 in the last 6 months?
The best thing I've ever in the last 6 months, stickers for my kids. They just really couldn't entertain themselves with stickers for a very long time.
Good answer. Do you have a quote or mantra that resonates with you?
A quote or mantra that resonates with me. There's a quote that I'm going to butcher, but it's that you could love anyone as soon as you hear their story. And I believe that should be true. Like if you hear someone's full story, you can always find a way to love them somehow.
I think that's very true. Do you believe in ghosts? Have you ever seen or felt one?
I have never seen a ghost, but, I've never seen a ghost. I wish I had.
A story in the hesitation. Have you ever been to a psychic?
I have not, no.
Final question. What does the first 60 minutes of your day look like?
The first 60 minutes of my day are... I have two kids, they're 2 and 5, and at 6 a.m. a green light goes off in their room, and that means they're allowed to leave, and they crawl into bed with my husband and I, and it's a very snuggly time, but it's also taught me just like that the line between affection and aggression in young boys is a much thinner line than you might think. Hug, and then somehow someone hurts each other and they cry. Yes, and then they love each other again. And then we're off. So that's the beginning of my day.
Overzealousness. I thought when you said green light that was going to be metaphoric, but it sounds like it's literal.
So it's an actual green light. There's like a alarm clock that turns green.
I love that.
That was also something under $100 that I'm glad we bought recently.
So it's alarm-based, is it? Or clock-based?
Yeah, it's an alarm-based light that turns the color. You can,
green light, go. I love that. Jessica Weisberg, thank you for sharing your wisdom and time with us today. You can find show notes for this episode of The Next Step at katherinecollette.com. You can get in touch via that website or via Instagram at katherinecolletteWriter.